Bug Soother has its origins in the 2008 floods. Now, the natural bug repellent made by a family in Columbus Junction is going global. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A half dozen quick conversations about the news this hour to end the week, including Iowa lawmakers on the brink of adjournment, a new study that shows swine farmers are more likely to carry drug-resistant staph infection, how is Fred Hoiberg likely to fare with the Chicago Bulls, and how will ISU cope without him, and Iowa State University's Heartland Marimba Festival. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Half dozen quick conversations about some news to end the week that we didn't get to earlier in the week on our talk shows. A little bit later in the program, a new study that shows swine farmers are more likely to carry drug-resistant staph infection. Also, Mike Loss of the Gazette will be along. We'll talk to him about how Fred Hoiberg is likely to fare with the Chicago Bulls and how the Iowa State Cyclones are coping without him, or will be coping without him. That's still to come. Also, Bug Soother. Maybe you have a bottle of it at your home or in your car. We'll talk with the developer of Bug Soother. That natural repellent is going global. But first, Iowa lawmakers are on the brink of adjournment for this session. Joining us with the latest, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Ben.
So lawmakers were up late last night and resumed early this morning?
They weren't up as late last night as we thought they were going to be, because we thought they were going to, you know, pull an all-nighter and finish.
Okay, something like 10:30, yeah.
They've actually put in very long days all week long, and then they were going to try to push through to the end last night, and, you know, just too many unresolved issues, okay. So they're back at it today.
Okay, where do things stand?
It looks likely they'll be done by the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's happening at this moment?
Well, they're still behind the scenes working on the standings bill. That's the bill that everything and anything can get attached to. And but Senator Granstall last night said it was 99.9% complete. He didn't see any roadblocks. But, you know, this is the last chance for people to get their pet projects in, and apparently there are still some of those that they're negotiating on.
Mm-hmm. We're, something like a month past the last paid day for legislators. What took so long this session?
Well, it was largely a disagreement over the budget. Everyone predicted this was going to be a tough budget year, and it turned out to be very much that. I think maybe the surprising thing is how strongly House Republicans prevailed in this discussion. Democrats in the Senate were holding out for more education funding just until a week ago. They said they got the best that they could get. But the House Republicans have a budget which is largely being adopted as far as the overall spending, and Senate Democrats and the governor were asking for quite a bit more. So I think that House Republicans really came out the winner here. You might have expected that with the governor and the Democrats sort of on the same page that they could have gotten more spending on the table, but that didn't turn out to be the case. Now, there are some areas where Democrats were able to boost spending here and there, but the overall spending level is just where the House Republicans wanted it.
Mm-hmm. Looking back over the session as a whole, when we go back to January when this session started, what will you remember about it most?
Well, I think that there's the two things that are going to have the most ramifications, and that the session will almost certainly be remembered for, would be the increase in the gas tax, which got wrapped up very early in the session, and then the school start date, which had been unable to be resolved for years, and Governor Branstad finally sort of forced the issue, said we're not going to let schools start early, you know, automatically get a waiver and start earlier. And because his weight was behind that, they were able to get that passed. And now I believe it is the week of August 23rd before which schools can no longer start their school year. And this fall will be the first time when that's when that would really make a difference. In other words, schools adjourned at their regular, you know, at their regular time, and but they're going to have to start later in the fall. So one complaint I heard about that is that people who have their school-aged kids in daycare are going to have a slightly bigger daycare bill because they ended according to the old schedule. They're going to be starting according to the new schedule. So I think those really are the two things that the session will be known for.
Mm-hmm. Were there things that you might have expected to get through that didn't make it this time?
Oh, I think probably the governor's anti-bullying bill, he has really put a lot of stock in that. It's a very important issue to him. He knows people personally, maybe not personally as friends, but he has been sitting around the table with people who've been the victims of bullying incidents. And so this is a really important issue to him. But for the second year in a row, the legislature has not been able to sign off on that, and it was House Republicans dragging their feet. Publicly the Republicans will say is schools can already do this. They feel that it would take authority out of the hands of parents. What's not being said publicly is that some House Republicans are very offended by the gay and lesbian advocacy. They've been outspoken about that, and of course, gay and lesbian advocacy is one of the things behind the governor's bullying bill. So that there was hope that would get resolved in this last-minute spending bill. The word is now that, you know, this is the point where they just have to start throwing right. things overboard. The bullying bill was in the Senate's version of the standing bill, but it has now gotten thrown overboard. I sent an email this morning to the governor's press person. Is he going to try again next year? And he didn't answer that. So it was a more general statement of the governor will continue to work hard to prevent bullying in schools without committing to whether
right.
he could actually try again next year.
You've covered the legislature for many years. Is this one of the more productive sessions or sort of in the middle of the road?
I saw one estimate of, if you want to look at just the sheer number of bills passed and signed into law, most everything that they've passed has already been signed into law because the governor has only 3 days to sign bills, except for the ones that are getting passed in the very last days of the session. Then he has 30 days. But so I've heard some numbers about the overall number of bills that have made it through the divided legislature and gotten signed by the governor is lower than some other years. Some people would say that's not really a sign of productivity because there are a lot of bills that are not very just kind of tweaking the Iowa code. But just having a smaller number of bills passed, that's just kind of a function of the divided legislature as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good, Joyce. Thanks for bringing us up to date live from the state capitol. We'll look forward to your reporting as the legislature wraps up its business. You think today yet, right?
Looks like it.
Okay, Joyce Russell. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Under a bill that passed both houses of the legislature Wednesday evening, any Iowa woman wanting an abortion would have to be offered the chance to look at an ultrasound of the fetus before undergoing the procedure. Women would also have to be offered information about abortion alternatives, including adoption. Tony Lays is with us, a health reporter at the Des Moines Register. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Ben.
So what exactly does this law, it has yet to be signed into law, I guess, what would it change?
Well, it depends who you talk to. Planned Parenthood, which is the main provider of abortion in Iowa, says they already do these things routinely anyway. they're not happy about the legislature telling them what to do, but they say it won't have much practical effect. The pro-life folks say this is their biggest victory they've had in years up at the Iowa legislature, and they think it's a big deal to see it put into law.
Mm-hmm. So if Planned Parenthood says we do it anyway, how do the anti-abortion folks see it as a great victory?
Well, there's not much trust between those two sides, so they wanted to see it put in law. What this law doesn't do is say that a woman would have to look at that picture. It would just have to be offered to her. There are a couple states that do require them to look at it in most cases, and that would have been a much bigger deal.
Mm-hmm. So a woman going in wanting an abortion, in this bill, this is a human services budget bill, the doctor says, would you want to see a sonogram? And the woman can decline, and that's the end of it then?
That's my understanding of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So also another provision on this related to the governor and abortion. Tell us about that.
Oh, well, Iowa is the only state in the country that requires the governor to personally approve any Medicaid spending on abortions. That rule has been in effect since 2013. The governor has never been asked to do it because nobody has been submitting bills for abortion since that went into effect. But he did not ask for it to be extended. But the House Republicans decided they at least like the symbolism of that being there, and they see it as a backstop.
Mm, okay.
So they put it back in.
Okay, so they put it back in. The governor did not ask for it, but he also did not refuse it.
He hasn't signed the bill yet. It'll be interesting to see what he does. He said that he didn't mind having the responsibility, but since he hadn't been asked to use it, he didn't see the point in extending it. The reason he hasn't been asked to use it is the only agency that had been billing for Medicaid abortions was the University of Iowa, had been billing a few a year, and they decided to quit doing that because they didn't want to get involved in the politics here.
Mm, okay. So talk about this sonogram provision across the country. How you said Iowa is unique for this latest provision about the governor personally approving any Medicaid spending for abortions. But what about the sonogram? Do states deal with that differently, too?
There are about 18 states or so that have a similar rule to what Iowa just put in place. The pro-choice folks see this as an attempt to discourage women from having abortions, and I think, again, it would have been a much bigger deal if there had been any serious discussion of requiring that women actually look at it.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the politics behind this deal, because I understand that perhaps it was part of a deal between Senate Democrats and House Republicans?
Again, it depends who you talk to. The House Republican told me that it was essentially a trade-off for the Democrats wanted to keep open a mental hospital in Mount Pleasant, and Republicans agreed to support that in the same bill if the Democrats would agree to the sonogram language on abortion. It was kind of a surprise that suddenly this was included in a bill that passed both houses, because there hasn't been much on abortion that's passed both houses in Iowa for years.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody made a deal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We might not find out what exactly that deal was. Any reaction from Democrats that's notable here?
They have not been very talkative about it. They have put out pretty scant statements about their thinking on it. They tend to be more pro-choice, and Planned Parenthood is not happy about this. So I guess it's not surprising that Democrats aren't talking much. I think we're going to have much bigger news on abortion within the next few weeks. The Supreme Court is going to rule on a telemedicine system that Planned Parenthood uses here. It's the only one of its kind in the country being used. That's going to be a much bigger deal and could have a big practical effect.
So that is an Iowa case that could have national ramifications?
Well, it's the Iowa Supreme Court. It's an Iowa case.
Okay.
But people around the country are watching it because Iowa is the only state that is in any major way using a system like this to provide abortion pills to women in rural clinics.
Mm-hmm. Is Iowa sort of a trendsetter there, or this technology certainly exists elsewhere? It's just not being used the same way?
Well, it was developed, this specific version of it was developed here. There have been several states that have passed preemptive laws against it to try to keep it out. But there are a lot of folks watching it nationally to see how this is going to play out here before I think they would invest in this kind of system in their state. So that's going to be a much bigger practical deal than this bill that passed the legislature. But it does sound like the governor, at least on the sonogram part of it, he welcomed it. And so it sounds like it is going to become law.
Okay. Tony Lays, health reporter at the Des Moines Register. Thank you for the conversation.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Really pretty decent weather we've been having this first week of June. Well, that is, if it weren't for those... pesky gnats. However, our gnat problem has meant big business for one Iowa company for several years now. Joining us, Frida Seiko is CEO of Simply Soothing, makers of bug soothers. It's a family-owned business located in Columbus Junction, Iowa. Frida, great to have you back on the program.
Well, thanks for asking us.
Well, your big seller, I know you have several products, but bug soother is the product that our listeners, it's a good chance that they have it sitting in their kitchen. I certainly do. In your car, it's a natural gnat and bug repellent that you developed in 2008. Perhaps a little bit into the origins in just a moment, but to the news here, you're beginning to sell internationally.
Yes, we are. We launched in the UK a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm. Why did you launch? What gave you the idea that you would be able to sell in the UK and other places in the world?
Well, we had a guy named Willie Petrie that contacted us, 2013. And he'd read an article on us in the paper, and he wanted to see if they would work on the midges over there. So he pestered us until we finally got it over there.
Mm-hmm. Had you
we call him Persistent Willie.
Persistent Willie. Had you heard stories of people perhaps putting it in their luggage to export it themselves?
Yes.
Outside? You had?
Yes. People take it all over the world. We hear stories back constantly. I can't think of hardly a country somebody hasn't told us they took it to.
Hmm. What other places do you have your eyes on in the world where you think your bug soother would be put to good use?
Well, we would like to launch it in Panama. We've been working with a man down there that owns, a pharmaceutical company, some kind of a medical company. We met him on a trade mission with Iowa a year ago this February.
Mm.
So we're trying to get all the paperwork done so we can get it started down there.
Certainly plenty of pests that wouldn't like bug soother, or would love to be soothed, I guess I should say. bug soother, another area of expansion, animals?
Yes, that's been our biggest one right now. We're trying to... Well, there's so many opportunities. We just try to focus on so many at a time. But the horses, it works really well on horses and dogs. So we're trying to get started with some packaging that would work for to put on horses or larger animals.
Tell us, remind us, how Bug Soother came to be.
Well, I created it in 2008 during the year of the flooding. Of course, we're down at the junction of the Iowa and the Cedar. And I created it for a five-month-old grandson, you know, wanting something safe to put on him, having no idea it would end up what it's done. I said if I'd known all that at the beginning, I might have named it differently, but I said we're pretty stuck with the name now.
Now, this is something, you have a background that leads up to this. What is your background that made you so interested in these types of oils or scents or whatever is in bug soother?
Well, my daughter and I created Simply Soothing in 2003, I believe, using essential oils and different kinds of scents. But I actually worked at Monsanto for 23 years, and I worked in the lab for several of those years. So I don't have a chemist background, but I worked with little batches and emulsifiers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. How much can you tell us about what is in bug soother?
Well, it's lemongrass and lemon and vanilla are the scents that people are smelling. And then castor oil, soy lecithin, the emulsifier, and then some vitamin E. So it's a pretty simple recipe.
Mm-hmm. And do you have it patented?
No, we do not have it patented. We actually got it on the market and it was kind of questionable, but we have what we call a trade secret, where there's only a handful of people that know how to make it. It's not easy to make.
You probably don't want to reveal this, but I'll ask it anyway. Why is it hard to make?
Oil and water, because it's basically water, and the oils don't, you know, oil and water doesn't mix. So there was a lot of work to get it to where it would emulsify.
Mm-hmm. And the recipe hasn't been tweaked, changed since your creation of it in 2008?
No. Actually, right now, though, I have a niece that's working on a better formula on it, but I don't see that happening this year.
Mm-hmm. What could possibly?
We've been asked for stronger recipes of it too, like to put on a stronger chemical, or not stronger chemical, but stronger ingredients. But all that's kind of in the works. It's nothing we're doing yet. And we're also working on a candle,
a bug soother candle with the same sorts of ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that you think could be improved with bug soother?
Well, there's some people wanting to know if we could do a concentrate that they could water down, and I think that would be fairly easy, like for the larger animals. One of the things is it's very effective for gnats, but a little less so with mosquitoes. You know, depends on the person.
Right.
So we might even come out at some point with one that's specifically for mosquitoes. We're still kind of, you know, right now we're just busy. You know, we only have so many hours in the day. So
right.
We're trying to stay focused on what we're doing right now. But
this is your season, the gnat season. How much more than that?
It's our season.
How much more than that season you think we have?
Well, last year it ran into the end of July quite a ways, and I'm not sure. You know, it can run anywhere from a couple of weeks to 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. What do those gnats want with us anyway?
Blood. They need blood. It's the female gnats that are hatching eggs, and that's where they go after the people wanting their blood,
mm-hmm.
like a mosquito.
Yeah.
You know, basically same thing.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know, but what don't they like about these essential oils, the lemongrass and vanilla in bug soother?
Well, they don't like a lot of essential oils. I mean, I didn't come up with the idea to use essential oils. They've been around a long time. Plants, you know, there's certain plants. Lemongrass specifically for mosquitoes, they hate the smell of lemongrass.
Before we go, give us an idea of how many of these bottles are sold in gnat season.
Well, we've got right now at the beginning of the season, we had 1.5 million bottles filled and ready to go because we've always ran out. So this year, we worked since last year to make sure everybody's got plenty. So, and the other thing that's happened is it's just gotten so popular that we're selling at a lot more places. But at I was figuring out this morning, by mid-May, we had already sold what we had sold for the year in 2013.
Wow, you are going gangbusters with Bug Soother.
We're going gangbusters. We're wanting 1 year that we don't run out so people don't have to try to find it somewhere.
All right. Frida Seiko, you take care. Thanks for the conversation.
Well, thank you.
After a short break, we talk about the significance of a new study that shows swine farmers are more likely to carry drug-resistant staph infection than people without swine exposure. How is Fred Hoiberg likely to fare with the Chicago Bulls? And how the heck will ISU cope without him? Your News Buzz continues after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations on Fridays. We like to touch on a number of things on Fridays to wrap up the week. Coming up yet this half hour, how is Fred Hoiberg likely to fare with the Chicago Bulls, and how will Iowa State University cope without him? Mike Halas will be along of the Gazette, a sports columnist there. Also, Jacqueline Hallbloom still to come, Iowa Public Radio classical music host and host of Iowa Public Radio's monthly Iowa Arts Showcase will be giving us a combined look at June and July. Lots of fascinating arts activities happening around the state. But first of all, if you're a swine farmer, you're more likely to carry multi-drug-resistant staph infection than people without swine exposure. That's according to a study we heard about this week, conducted by a team of researchers from the University of Iowa, Kent State University, and the National Cancer Institute. It's a study published online in the journal Clinical Infectious Diseases. Here to tell us about it is Tara Smith, currently associate professor at Kent State University. She conducted the study while she was a faculty member at the University of Iowa in Iowa City at the College of Public Health. Tara, welcome to this program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So tell us more about what you found here and why you were interested in this.
Mm-hmm. So we had done some previous studies in the area looking at Staph aureus in swine farmers, but they were all pretty small, about 60 people or so. So what we wanted to do was do a larger study and look at farmers throughout the state, including swine farmers. We also looked at cattle and chickens and other animals. But we wanted to look at not only carriage, but also infection. So when we enrolled these farmers, we followed them for 18 months to see not only who was carrying Staph aureus and what types of Staph aureus, but also who was actually getting sick from it.
Mm-hmm. And what is the significance of your findings?
Well, we did find that swine farmers are at a high risk of carrying staph that is resistant to multiple antibiotics. So this means that not only are they at risk for infections, but they can also spread this to potentially family members and others. And we did find that kind of the big black box before was, is this making people sick? And is this actually a health concern for farmers? And we did find that a number of people were getting sick from the staph aureus that they're exposed to.
Mm-hmm. So they're carriers and they may or may not be exhibiting symptoms?
Right. So when you carry it, you just have the bacterium usually in your nose, sometimes in your throat, sometimes elsewhere in the body. But it's not necessarily making you sick. It's just, you know, living in and on your body. It's when the bacteria can either breach the skin or sometimes causes boils, abscesses, things that look like big pimples, or when it infects a wound that it actually makes you ill, and that's when it starts to become a public health risk.
Mm-hmm. And it's also a public health risk because it's drug resistant, right?
Right, exactly. So it makes it much more difficult to treat.
Mm-hmm. So there were people you treated who it was news to them that they had this Staph aureus infection.
Right. Well, we can't actually, because we're not a diagnostic lab, we couldn't actually tell them that they were carrying this. So they reported Staph aureus infections to us that either were diagnosed from their doctor or we gave them a card that showed kind of what typical staph infections look like. So when they had anything that looked like that, they would take a swab of it and send it to us if they didn't go to their doctor.
Mm-hmm. So what is the wider significance of what you found out here? Where does it translate to? Who is going to be most interested in this, perhaps outside of swine farmers?
Mm-hmm. Well, anyone who is interested in antibiotic resistance, and just a few days ago at the White House was a big panel and forum on antibiotic resistance in the United States. The concern is that we're moving toward basically a post-antibiotic era, that we're going to go back to the early 1900s when, you know, any scratch could be fatal. We're running out of drugs to use to treat these infections. There aren't many new ones in the pipeline, so we really need to preserve what we have. And one aspect of that, of course, is preserving antibiotics in human medicine, but another is also appropriately using antibiotics in livestock. And so that's what we were looking at here.
Mm-hmm. Does this have any bearing as well on avian flu? The CDC earlier this week, we had conversations about this, issued a, I don't know if it was a warning or advisory for doctors and public health officials in states to be on the lookout for avian flu in humans.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. Obviously, very different pathogens. We're looking at bacteria. The avian flu is a virus, but it's the same population that would be exposed, which are, you know, farmers working with these animals. And they're often, you know, Iowa farmers. Often the times they're very hesitant to go to the doctor unless they're on death's door. And so lots of times they really kind of get missed by healthcare professionals because they just don't show up if they're only mildly ill. So, you know, kind of the same thing with this, like they're encouraging individuals who are especially in contact with poultry that if they are sick, that if they have something that's maybe a flu-like symptoms, to go to their doctor to see if it is, you know, potentially avian influenza.
Mm-hmm. How often do bacteria or virus jump species from animals, non-human animals, to humans?
Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly, but most of the new infections that we've seen over the last 30 years or so from SARS to right now there is another virus called MERS that has emerged in South Korea and has been in Saudi Arabia for a number of years, to Ebola. All of these originally come from animals. So we know that most of the new infections that we see probably had an origin in animals.
Okay, thank you very much. Tara Smith is currently a faculty member at Kent State University. She conducted part of this study while she was a faculty member at the University of Iowa that said if you're a swine farmer, you're more likely to be carrying multi-drug-resistant staph infection than people without swine exposure. Tara Smith, thank you for joining us live.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about some news items we didn't get to earlier this week to wrap up our week. On Tuesday of this week, Iowa State University men's basketball coach Fred Hoiberg was named as the next coach of the Chicago Bulls. Hoiberg is a native of Ames. He starred at Iowa State and coached the Cyclones for five seasons. That was after a 10-year playing career in the NBA. Joining us now to talk a bit about it, Mike Loss, sports columnist at the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Cyclone fans, though, basketball fans in Ames, sad about the news, but it's been talked about for a while, hasn't it?
Yes, but it was one of those things that I don't think that a lot of people wanted to really accept or believe, and then it happened. And, you know, it's like when, you know, a treasured family member goes off and takes a job in another part of the country, you know it's a possibility, and they talk about it, but all of a sudden it happens, and the realization is pretty hard to deal with, and I think that's what's going on in Cyclone Country.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the Bulls think Hoiberg is the right man for the job?
Well, there's a deep level of comfort with the Bulls front office and Hoiberg. The general manager, Gar Forman, was an assistant coach at Iowa State when Hoiberg played there, was in the organization when Hoiberg played for the Bulls. And so there's trust. The previous coach, Tom Thibodeau, had a very strained relationship with Forman and with John Paxson, who's also a Bulls executive. And that's the kind of thing you can put up with when somebody's successful for 1 or 2 years, but after 5 years, you start looking for reasons to make a change. They did. They were tired of Thibodeau. They found him hard to work with, and they're going with somebody who, from a personality standpoint, seems to be the opposite.
Do we know the terms of his contract with the Bulls?
It's pretty sweet, standard for a pro coach. 5 years, $25 million. You know, almost twice what he was making at Iowa State. But I believe him when he says that it's not about the money, and that's a sports cliche that when somebody says it's not about the money, it's about the money. But I don't think he's making this move for financial reasons, although, I mean, he wouldn't be going to Chicago to work for peanuts. It's competition. It's a challenge. It's somebody who I think is just better suited for the pro game, where you're focused on coaching, and all you do is coach, really. Coach and coach games and be the coach at practices and film sessions. College coaching involves a lot of things.
So that's really the transition that faces Fred Hoiberg from college to a professional team, is his field of interest, his focus becomes narrower?
Yeah, I think so. You got to remember, he has spent more time in his basketball career in the NBA than he has in college basketball. You said that he was a player for 10 years, and besides that, he was in the Minnesota Timberwolves front office for 4 years. So he's seen all sides of the NBA life, from the player's aspect and from management's point of view. And now he's sort of the connector to the two as the coach. So if a guy has spent 14 years in it and finds it appealing, that's where he's going to want to be. And a lot of college coaches aren't cut out for the pro life, because a lot of the reason to be a major college coach is the power, the control. Some coaches don't put as much emphasis on that as much as the challenge and of the ability to be around the best athletes in the world. And I think that's where Hoiberg is.
As we mentioned, of course, a great loss by Cyclone fans throughout the state and beyond. How optimistic is the search for his replacement?
It's going to be pretty tight-lipped, I think. Iowa State is doing what a lot of schools do. They've gone to a search firm. This one's Parker Executive Search in Atlanta. They're notoriously secretive, as you would have to be in that business to be effective. The question's going to be just how big a name or names are going to eventually apply for this job. I don't think that we're going to know some of the people who do apply until after the fact. There are names that are out there right now, but I think that some of them might be smokescreens. I think that some of them might just be names that agents want put out there just to enhance the profile of these coaches. Coaches at mid-majors, smaller universities like Murray State and Stephen F. Austin. Very good coaches and very reputable coaches who've done great things the last few years. But this is a team that, you know, a lot of people think has Final Four potential. And it could attract some surprisingly big names.
Hmm. Well, do you have any names on the top of your list that you want to mention?
No, I don't. I think that if it's not T.J. Otzelberger, who is the top assistant on the current staff that Hoiberg's left behind, then I think it's going to be a surprise.
A surprise?
But that's not, you know, that's not saying much, but I think there's going to be somebody out there who says, I can walk right into a roster that's got top five talent. And that can be a very powerful, powerful thing for college coaches.
Mm-hmm. What's the timeline? When will we know?
Well, the university president said today that they might take 2 or 3 weeks, but I think it's got to be faster than that. I think within a week this will be wrapped up.
Okay. Mike Halas, we'll wait and see. Sports columnist at the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, thank you for the insights.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's time to play Name That Tune, or better yet, Name That Instrument playing that tune. That's, of course, the theme from Pirates of the Caribbean, played on the, yes, you guessed it, marimba. Well, if you like the marimba, you'll want to give a listen to this month's Iowa Arts Showcase. Joining me now, Jacqueline Hallblum, Iowa Public Radio classical music host and host of Iowa Public Radio's monthly Iowa Arts Showcase, which airs tomorrow, Saturday, at 11 o'clock and 5 in the afternoon on Iowa Public Radio Classical. Hello again, Jacqueline.
Hey, Ben.
So, marimba fans can go see what this month?
Well, it's the Marimba Festival and Academy. It starts on June 13th, and it's run by Matthew Colley, who is a marimbist extraordinaire. And he has had this festival going now. This is the second year. It's in residence at ISU. And they're going to have some pretty amazing things going on. They're giving 6 concerts as well as having this academy. And they're going to have a marimba orchestra. So
you're kidding. So that
no, I'm not.
only marimbas allowed on stage?
I think so.
Whoa.
It's going to be a big glob of marimbas, and they're all going to be playing, and it's going to be fabulous. And it's a wonderful way to be introduced to the instrument. A lot of the concerts are free that they're giving. It's a fabulous opportunity, and it's right here in Iowa.
Okay. So as we look at the Iowa Arts Showcase, of course, your program, Jacqueline, all about looking at arts highlights from across the state. The Bellin Quartet is showcasing some violinists this month as well, aren't they?
Well, actually, they're showcasing 5 instrumentalists. 3 of them happen to be violinists, the other 2 a cellist and a violist. And the Bellin String Quartet, this is their 15th season, and it was basically started by a generous grant from the lawyer, violinist, and philanthropist David Bellin, who in his will stipulated to have some money set up to have musicians play quartet music during the summertime. And they're going to be giving 10 free string quartet concerts. They've already started. They're on Friday afternoons, usually starting around 12:15 or 12:30 in downtown Des Moines.
Mm-hmm.
It's a marvelous gift and just a wonderful way to spend the summer.
Tell us a little bit more about these five musicians and the works they'll be playing.
Well, they select 10 of their favorite quartets every year. They duke it out and decide which ones they're going to play. And there are three violinists, a violist and cellist, all from the Des Moines Symphony. And they go around each week playing a different quartet. And then one week, I think it's the 11th of July, they're going to be playing a quintet where all five of them play. So it's really a great opportunity. They have quartets of Brahms and all sorts of different marvelous performances. So a great way to hear some classical music, enjoy your summer lunch in downtown Des Moines, and it's free.
Mm-hmm. In Mason City, there's some recent renovations that have happened to a Frank Lloyd Wright structure. It will be reopened this summer?
Well, actually, it's been open now. It opened in 2011. But I think the real story behind this is not only the structure, but that the people in Mason City really stepped up to the plate. They were going to bulldoze this thing down, and a lot of people in the community came forward and pulled together, raised $20 million, incorporated people from the community to help with construction, architects, the whole nine yards. And now they have the only, get this, the only remaining hotel in the world designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. Hmm. And you can stay in it. The deal is, though, you got to get your reservation in early because people love to stay in here. It's booked solid all the time. And there's the boutique hotel. There's this 1910 restaurant that you can eat at, gourmet restaurant, which is fabulous. And then the Ride on the Park Foundation is separate, and they are the ones who keep the building maintained and are working to spread the love of architecture to Iowans. So it's fabulous.
It's actually
a lot of fun.
It is a magnificent structure, the Frank Lloyd Wright, the Park Hotel there. I happened to see it last year on RAGBRAI, but I was so sweaty and smelly, Jacqueline. And it's so magnificent, I didn't want to mix the two, so I didn't go in.
Well, they do give tours, and you can take tours of it, and it's a fabulous renovation, and they did it the quote-unquote right way because they went about it, and they involved historical societies and tried to get as much of the original things back in it as they could. So it's pretty amazing.
You're looking this month at what the Des Moines Metro Opera has on offer to finish up our conversation here. What's going on there?
Well, the Des Moines Metro Opera is in their 43rd season, and they have three main stage operas this summer. And we have to say that the Des Moines Metro Opera is nationally recognized. And if you haven't been there yet, you better get there. And this year, what's really cool is Michael Eagle, their executive director, said that they're having all operas with happy endings, which doesn't always happen. But
not very often.
No, but it's still fabulous singing. They bring singers in from all across the globe, really fantastic singers. They're going to be doing an opera in Czech this year, Jenifa, the first time they've ever done a Czech opera. They're doing The Girl of the Golden West, which is a Puccini opera that he wrote, a Western opera, if you can believe that, and Mozart's Abduction from the Seraglio. So many cool things happening. Plus, they have their second stages series with Rappaccini's Daughter. So lots of neat things and just a marvelous way to hear some incredible opera right here in Indianola.
Okay, Jacqueline Hallbloom, host of the Iowa Arts Showcase. This program tomorrow, airing tomorrow on Iowa Public Radio at 11 and again at 5 p.m., we'll be looking at happenings in Iowa in both June and July. We appreciate you keeping us abreast of that, Jacqueline Hall Bloom. And I think we're going to go out with a little bit of the Mozart that you mentioned, right? And, mm-hmm. Opera's nothing if you don't have a little bit of narrative. So what's the narrative to the abduction from
the Seraglio?
Yes, thank you.
Well, this is Mozart, and it's an early opera, and there's a harem and all sorts of cool things going on in between this and tenors that sing up a storm. This is the overture from that abduction from the Seraglio Des Moines Metro performing it this summer.
And it will have a happy ending, according to Jacqueline.
It will. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Jacqueline Hallblum. And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you want to hear a podcast of this program or any of our other prior talk shows, go to iowapublicradio.org. You'll find podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River and Talk of Iowa. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Here's our email, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.